tonight with undefeated Pitt in a tough position against Syracuse, right? Could they be
absolutely
the first of the weekend? And then BYU, as you mentioned, they're undefeated on the road against a UCF team that hasn't even looked very good, and they're a dog. Like, I mean, they're very clearly expected to get exposed here. So, like, that's what this week is about for me, and Missouri's included in that. Is like, all right, there's a lot of one-loss and undefeated teams out there who really are not passing the eye test. Will the results finally match what we've been seeing?
Also in this window, is Diego Pavia the best quarterback Texas has seen?
I think surely Carson Beck is a better player, right? Like, than Diego Pavia?
So I'm still kind of defending Beck. I think more of Beck's, like, Beck's had some bad turnovers, but they don't have a running game. It's all on him, and they're chunking it. If you chunk it a lot, you're going to make a mistake here and there. I think their receivers have been worse. He's obviously a significantly better pro prospect than Diego Pavia, but Pavia is a different type of challenge that Texas has seen. And I do wonder, like, because in your head, this feels like the ultimate get-right spot for Texas. Like, go to Vanderbilt and show that's a different class of athlete. I just don't think we've seen Vandy be a get-right game this year.
No, they haven't been. I'll be there for this one, so I'm excited for it. But Texas hasn't really been tested defensively because Georgia was so bad offensively against them and set up with such short fields by virtue of how well the Georgia defense played, how poor the Texas offense played, that we really still haven't gotten a read on the Texas defense.
I felt like Georgia had one drive. That one drive when it got to, what was it, 23-15?
Yeah, Georgia kind of went out and on a death march.
But
yeah.
Other than that, I'm with you. Like, most of the scoring was done by just having unbelievable field position.
Yeah, right. But then it's another question, Texas offensively against Vanderbilt.
Right.
Because Alabama really didn't have a whole lot of trouble scoring against Vanderbilt. Jalen Milroe had a couple of really costly turnovers in that game.
They had the pick six off the tip ball and then the strip sack.
Right. And outside of that, most of Alabama's possessions ended in touchdowns or points. So that's what it comes down to for me. Vanderbilt, again, probably going to have to win that turnover battle, probably going to have to get some help in special teams. Like, they're almost a 3-touchdown underdog. So it would be like lightning striking twice if Vanderbilt took down Alabama and Texas in the same season.
What did you make of Sark putting in Arch for that two series and then going back to Ewers?
I didn't make too much of it. I think it was a struggling team that has another really good quarterback on the roster, and that I know there's a lot of people trying to read into it about, well, I bet Quinn Ewers is injured, or this shows who Sark really believes is the best quarterback on the roster. I can't definitively rule that stuff out, but when you're just getting your face caved in a national marquee spot, you got to try something different. When Max Scherzer, on the rare night where he gets beat up and is down 8-0 in the third inning, you don't leave him in. You go to the bullpen. I think he was just going to the bullpen.
I'm with you. I thought it kind of served a couple things. Number one, Arch is a much better runner than Quinn. And I think when you know there's a 0% chance our offensive line is going to block their defensive line, let's at least put in a guy that can use his legs a little bit. Maybe we'll find a spark that way. I also think it was kind of like, it felt to me the game was really speeding up for Ewers. It's like, all right, let's sit him down. Let's let him have a couple of looks from the sidelines. Calm him down. We'll go into the half. We'll regroup. And Ewers played better in the second half. But, like, yeah. I'm not putting that loss on Ewers. That loss was on the fact that when Georgia's healthy up front on defense, they're unblockable.
Yeah, that was a Georgia we had not seen.
Yes. Literally because they haven't been healthy.
Yeah, I mean, the only time we'd seen that version of Georgia's defense was in the second half against Clemson, and really the whole game against Clemson. But that's been a long time now. And that's the thing with Georgia. It's like, clearly they have an elite gear. It's just how often and how consistently are we going to get to see it?
Yeah, I think that's more than fair. All right, let's get to the night slate. So we got LSU at Texas A&M. Surprise, this is for first place in the SEC. These are the only two remaining unbeaten teams. And honestly, you can make a case. I know LSU has got Alabama left. Let's see. Do they have I think that's really LSU's only other test, right?
Well, they got Vandy.
Oh, excuse me. They have Vandy. And, like, Florida, that game's in Gainesville, and Florida hasn't died yet. Like, they've not quit on the season. They're not dead yet. I do think, though, what's interesting to me is A&M going to... To me, this is a game where A&M can prove the people that kind of believed in them during the offseason. You can kind of put the bad taste of the Notre Dame performance out of sight, out of mind. And if you win this game, you are very much not only back in the playoff conversation, Cobb, they're going to be in a situation where they're perhaps playing for a top seed.
Very well could be. We did our midseason All-American and awards voting about a week or so ago. I had Mike Elko as my national coach of the year because of what he inherited from Jimbo Fisher. And I don't mean the roster. Sure, there was good talent.
There was not a lot of buy-in.
Yeah, the culture, man. Like, maybe that's a cliche. Maybe that's a buzzword, right?
I'm a culture guy because you call it whatever you want. You know what it is more than anything? It's a team identity. I've never seen a good, I don't care if it's football, basketball, baseball, teams that just kind of are collections of talent, that's just not enough. Like, you have to have something that bonds you. Like, in the end, when it's like a 3rd and 3 and you got to get this play to win the game, like, what type of team are you? Like, I believe in all that.
Yeah, and look at what he did at Duke and how he was able to turn that thing around so quickly. He knows what he's doing. If they beat LSU, I think they're pretty much in the playoff, barring a toe stub against an Auburn,
yeah,
or a New Mexico State. I think Texas A&M more or less secures its spot in the playoff with a win, because this is going to be a really high-caliber win. Their only loss to this point is against Notre Dame. That's a really quality loss, if you want to call it that. And then even if they lose to Texas at the end of the season, I don't think you're really going to get penalized for losing to Texas. And so, yeah, if Texas A&M wins this game, I think they're in the playoff year one under Mike Elko. After all that ridiculousness under Jimbo Fisher. And to me, that would be just a remarkable coaching job by Mike Elko.
We also have Penn State going to Madison to take on Wisconsin. I mean, I don't know if I'd say, like, Wisconsin's on fraud watch, because I don't think anyone's sitting there stumping for Wisconsin. But I'm wondering if Wisconsin has really gotten better, or if they just played Purdue, Rutgers, and what do we have, Northwestern in there, sandwiched, yep, in there. Like, that's what I'm curious about that. And then on the nightcap, I think it's really interesting here with Cincinnati at Colorado. So, Cobb, I don't know if you saw this. Over at Sports Media Watch, they wrote about how last Saturday against Arizona is the lowest rated network performance for Colorado on television rating. I find this interesting. The hype was way more insane when the team was not as good. Like, listen, is Colorado going to win the Big 12? Probably not, but they're not out of it. And, like, here's one thing that we do know when Colorado's on the field. They're likely to have the best quarterback, and they are likely to have the best player.
Part of it, too, is the diminishing quality of the opposition.
Yes.
Think about who they were playing in the Pac-12 last year. Pac-12 was awesome.
The irony was, the last season was, like, actually legitimately a good season. Like, they had quality competitive teams
against big time national brand name teams. And the Big 12 is just sort of a conglomeration of good but not great brands. And so that's going to sag the ratings a little bit. And then let's be real, there hadn't been a whole lot of like Deion still says things that are kind of off the wall and they get written about. And, like, you know, Colorado is still a buzzy team, but there's not been any real, like, controversial jabs between the teams that have, like, reached the national zenith. Like, I don't envision Scott Satterfield out here talking crap about Colorado in his press conferences like the Colorado State coach did last year, you know? So, yeah, you're right, man. It's been a little less buzzy around Colorado this year.
And they're much better. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, Cobb over at CBS and his crew, they have got a great college basketball primer. Let's talk about where some Memphis guys might be on that. We'll talk all of that when we come back right here on Jeffrey Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Over at Robert Irwin Jewelers, it is the 47th anniversary sale, and they are celebrating by giving the opportunity to get 47% off one item in stores, or you can BOGO. You can buy one, get one free. Buy a 2-carat lab-grown diamond tennis bracelet for only $15.99 and get a half carat diamond studs, or I should say a pair of half carat diamond studs for free. You can also buy the 5 carat lab grown diamond tennis bracelet for only $27.99 and get a pair of 1 carat diamond studs for free. Or you can buy a 10 carat lab grown diamond tennis bracelet for $49.99 and get a pair of 2 carat diamond studs for free. It's the RIJ way to celebrate 47 years of making memories. Lots of financing options that can give you time to get it now and give it at the holidays. Bigger, brighter diamonds, better prices, all at Robert Irwin Jewelers, 5 locations, or you can shop online. Cobb, have you gotten your push gift yet?
Jeffrey.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen.
I'm still working on it, all right? I'm working on it.
I told my wife what her push gift was going to be when we had, the day we had Josephine. But like,
yeah, right. We've been in communication.
Mine was also, it was with her engagement ring. So it wasn't like I could just be like, hey, I need to borrow your engagement ring. Like, cause we added a couple of things to it. It's like, I can't just like take your engagement ring.
Well, that's exactly it. And I was really proud of the fact that I picked out her engagement ring without her like there in the store with me. You know what I mean? Like I had a friend who had seen her Pinterest board, and I had my sister come with me to sort of help advise during the selection process. And I nailed it. Like she loves it. And like, you know, anyway, though, this push present thing, one, we're like T-minus 3 weeks. So it's got to happen soon, but I think we've resolved that we're just gonna, you know, next time we're in town, we're gonna go. We're gonna look together.
I'm just glad we've added another gift to get women where all we can do is just at best tie. Like we're just hoping for a draw.
You know, I really prided myself early on in the relationship with like my gift giving skills.
Yeah,
and
you can't set the standard too high because then that's the rest of your life.
I know, and now, and that's like you know, like the love languages, right? Yeah, gifts are one of her love languages, right? So there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot riding on that. You know, I gotta get it right. But the thing is, like, she doesn't care if it's a surprise. So that helps a lot. So as long as she gets it, right? Like
right.
The affirmation.
You don't
received.
Have to have it the day the kid's born, but it's like, as long as it's inside an acceptable window of time,
yes.
Like you're good.
Yeah, I think so. And like she could, you know, it's not going to diminish the value if she's there with me picking it out.
Yeah.
Like, so that's what I mean. Like the surprise factor isn't like a deal breaker for her.
Yeah. I'd love to say I'm proud of myself because I too picked out my wife's ring on her own, but she literally like sent me with pictures. She's like, I want this. I was like, okay, well, I can get
hey,
back.
But even then, like I get nervous going to the grocery store because she's like, you know, we need this specific brand. And like I wander around the grocery store for 45 minutes looking for something while everything else in the cart is melting.
I mean, for sure on that one, it's like I'm from a family of boys. I went to boys' school. Like going into the world of diamonds, not exactly where your boy thrives. So like just getting out of that with a win was just absolutely monumental. All right, let's get in. All right, over at CBS Sports, of course, where you can find the work of David Cobb. We've got a lot of great college basketball previews. I think let's start with the team and then we'll go to players. So we have the top 101, which by the way, did Gary invent that? Like the 25
the and one thing. I don't know. That's our brand now. Everything
right.
at CBS is and one.
Is Gary getting a cut
side.
Of that?
I think Gary did because Gary still updates that top 25 and one almost every day during the season and pretty regularly during the off season. I think that I think he kind of started that.
All right, so the Tigers come in at 29, and honestly, my first reaction was, feels a little high, but also, like to me, I think the thing that we're going to see this year, and at least I'm gonna be interested, in college football, you know how we talk about like the flattening of it and where you have kind of like the teams that are maybe not the 5 best teams, but kind of top 10 teams, there's just not a lot of difference between that team and like the 35th team.
Right.
I feel like in college basketball, it's going to be pretty mushy from like 20 to 50.
Yeah, well, Matt is definitely higher on Memphis at 29 than most of the computer or analytics type
of
stuff.
So I've seen KenPom has him at 41.
Yeah, Evan Mia's got him at 51. Bart Torvik has him at 32. So if you know, if you're going off of Torvik, like 29 is not outrageous, but I would say 29 makes Matt a little bit of an outlier in this ranking here because most places you look, Memphis is maybe a top 40 team, if that. So, hey, I mean, it's good, though, to see somebody out there has got some faith in them. And look, we're going to find out pretty freaking early with this team, and we're going to keep learning about them when they play Alabama here in a few days. But the schedule is such that, you know, there's not going to be any hiding. Memphis is going to be either exposed as fraudulent, or they're going to have some really big wins here in the first few weeks of the season.
And see, this is kind of the other thing about the schedule. We've talked about how I believe the entire non-conference schedule, I don't think there's a sub. I think the worst team they play in non-con is Arkansas State at 121 in KenPom.
And picked to win the Sun Belt.
I would say, and projected to win their league. You're going to start to get the teams in the 200s when you get into league play. But my question is, what if the schedule gets to this team early? Are they still going to be able to put it together to dominate conference play and still be a tournament team? Because what we've seen is a lot of times when you have these teams that are assembled year to year, when it starts going poorly, it's tough to get it back on the rails.
Well, you, at that point, it's a three-game season.
Yeah.
If you flunk the non-con and you come out of it with six losses going into league play, which, let's be real, that's not even outside the realm of possibility with the quality of competition that Memphis is playing over these first couple of months, they could take five or six losses easy because of the schedule that he put together. And if that happens, then their only path to the NCAA tournament would be to win, in all likelihood, to win the AAC tournament. So, yeah, how do you keep all the transfers together, keep building momentum, building chemistry, and have everybody focused on that goal throughout the grind of a, let's be real, kind of a boring league slate? That would be a tremendous challenge for Penny Hardaway, but it wouldn't be impossible. All you got to do is beat three teams that you're better than and more talented than in the AAC tournament, and you're in.
Alabama at 1 for Matt, Houston at 2, Kansas at 3, UConn at 4, Duke at 5, Baylor 6, Purdue 7, Tennessee 8, Gonzaga 9, Carolina is at 10, St. John's at 11. I mean, I know Patino basically completely flipped the roster, but are they really going to be that good?
Well, they have got an All-American on their team in Kadarius Richmond, who, you know, is St. John's in Brooklyn or Queens?
Queens.
Yeah, okay. So
and then
Queens,
they play
St. John's.
Some games in the Garden, which is in Manhattan.
Yeah, and they just snagged Seton Hall's best player from Jersey within the league. So, I mean, if that doesn't tell you anything about Rick Pitino at age 72,
still got
as
it,
ruthless
baby
as ever, you know, going across to Hoboken or whatever to pick up their best player. I mean, that's just ruthless. No, I think St. John's at 11 is a little high for me. I think Tennessee's a little high at 8, to be honest, when you're going to be relying on some relatively unknown transfers. Like, I know everybody wants to say that Chaz Lanier is this year's Dalton Connect, but I think Dalton Connect was a special one-of-a-kind type of guy, and those are really, really big shoes to fill. So I would be a little lower on the Vols.
Is Tennessee going to be fun to watch again?
That's the question. I think they're going to be nasty defensively. They might even be better defensively, but I don't see how they are going to maintain that offensive improvement that they had a year ago. Because DK, man, he was
awesome, dude.
He was it.
He was new McBuckets.
Yeah. So I mean, he was unique. He made Tennessee by himself a better offensive team than any team Rick Barnes had since Grant Williams was there, and so. Yeah, so you're relying on Chaz Lanier, who's transferring up from North Florida in the Atlantic Sun. You're relying on Darlin Stone Dubar, who's transferring in from Hofstra. And then you're relying on Igor Milicic, who's transferring in from the AAC at Charlotte. I mean, we don't have to tell you guys how much the AAC or where they are in basketball. So it's like, that's a lot. The defensively, they're going to be great, but I just have a lot of questions about that, the offensive side of the ball for Tennessee.
Also at CBS Sports, you can check out the top 101 best players in college basketball. Memphis with one player, Tyrese Hunter, comes in at 95. And Cobb, I guess this would be my question. Does it say anything in your mind about Memphis that there's only one guy ranked?
Well, I think it says that GP and I have probably been burned enough over the last few years. Look, you got two Memphis guys who are voting on this thing. And I'll be real. I think that's helped Memphis have some representation on this list over the past few years.
Certainly don't think it's hurt.
Yeah, you go back to last year, for instance. Like, we had Jordan Brown on the list at number 95.
He was highly decorated.
I mean, we didn't know anything about him.
We didn't know that he would have the I can't play flu.
Yeah, and then so you go back before that, we had Kendrick Davis at 9. That was
okay, nice. That hit.
He was an All-American caliber player. We had DeAndre Williams at 47.
That
was fair. Here's where we missed on Memphis in the past. Going into the 2020-21 season, we had Amani Bates at 19.
Yeah, in fairness, though, everybody missed.
Yeah. We had Durant at 36, which I think was accurate.
That hit.
Close to it.
I mean, Durant's a good NBA player. Like, mm-hmm. There's some question of, is he putting up bad or good numbers on a bad team? But, like, he is putting up good numbers.
Here's another one we missed. Going into 2020-21, so COVID, we had Musa Cisse at 85. Boy, have things not come full circle. Now he's back with the Tigers and nowhere near this list.
And he didn't even play in the exhibition. I don't know. I'm quietly optimistic that this team can be a tournament team. When we talk about more than that, it's like, that's a bridge too far. But like, there's two challenges. One, other than really the Kendrick and DeAndre team, we've not seen one of Penny Hardaway's teams just cruise through conference play like they should. And I do have concerns that the schedule will get to them early, and by the time they get to conference play, are they still able and capable? Like, are they going to be enough of a team still to cruise through conference play, which they most certainly can. But like, those are the big questions I have. And then the other flip side of it is, like, I think the league's going to be bad, but kind of what we've seen in college basketball is when you think something's going to be bad, it ends up being kind of worse than you thought. And I think the league has a chance to be that as well.
Hey, well, look, as long as we don't have anybody else missing study hall and getting run.
Yeah, you gotta watch that. You got to watch out.
Like,
for
that's a big issue. Like, we can't be missing study hall now.
No, for sure.
We got to keep this thing on the rails.
Way too important. Yeah, you got to be there. All right, let's talk about these topics and more. We'll do it with Jason Smith next, right here on Jeffrey Wright & Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Hey, Jason Smith is the co-host of the Jason and John Show weekdays right here on 92.9 FM, ESPN from 11 until 2. He's on Twitter, on X, at Jason Smith 929. Jason, what was the most encouraging thing you saw from the Grizzlies last night?
Number one's got to be Ja Morant. I mean, obviously, and we talked about the level he takes you to just by being on the floor. I was listening to y'all earlier, just seeing him out there screaming at the opposing crowd, you know, screaming at Utah players. Now that's, you know, having that, Cobb said it, I mean, that joy was back, and it's usually on, you know, when Ja is playing, that joy is typically there. There's been too much of him not playing, obviously, but having him on the floor, on a night where you didn't have Jaren Jackson, there's no promise you go into what's supposed to be a bad, a bad Utah franchise organization, at least this year, and get that win. If you don't have 12 at the end of that game, you're probably still not winning it, even as well as things had gone earlier. And, that's got to be number one. I mean, after that, you know, you liked the way the Grizzlies shot the ball from three. You know, I would hope that continues. That's sort of where we started. And, you know, this new look offense, they've gone and made these changes to the staff, and hopefully with that, we've talked to Drew Hill a ton about it, is going to be a modernization, a sort of trying to get closer to what Boston's doing, where everybody on your damn team can shoot a three. And clearly in the way the Grizzlies drafted, set aside Edie, obviously the first pick, but in Jalen and Cam, you got guys who shot 40% from three, and you saw Jalen Wills able to do that in a spot where, you know, earlier this offseason, maybe even for parts of preseason, we thought, well, this is going to be a guy outside the rotation. Let's see what he can do. Well, he looked ready last night. So the way they shot the threes, I think it was 45 of them or somewhere around there, shot about 38 last year. Okay, that's up. Hopefully that continues. But more importantly, you know, you'd not be 29th in three-point field goal percentage. You know, that needs to improve. That was a good sign. And then, you know, I think ultimately the fact we were concerned about bench scoring going into this game because of how shorthanded you are, particularly on that second unit, and whether it was Conchar or Jalen Wells or whatever else with Vince and Gigi Kennard down, those guys last night were able to put together an effort that outscored Utah's bench. It's what you're going to need. And so for a night one, for a game one, and absolutely with the W right on top of it, you will absolutely take it. But Ja has to be the thing that obviously your eyes are drawn to most, thing you got to feel the best about.
All right, Jason. So what was the temperature for you guys on your show today about Zach Edey and his debut? Y'all pressing panic or kind of where y'all at?
I could sense a little bit of a moving of the goalpost on my partner. Now, just in terms of what he's expecting. Now, I'll say this. Now, John has been telling us for a while now, and against the advice of some others, that he thought Zach Edey is a bad Rookie of the Year bet. Now, he's got a list of reasons for that. I'm still in the camp that I think he's going to be in the running. I really are. We're a little bit separate. I wasn't as, ready to move those goalposts, ready to change opinions on what I think Zach Edey could be. Because, and I'll be honest with you, Cobb, I think mine are a little lower than where some others had put them this year. What I remember is that, I mean, what's clear is that, you know, there's going to be a huge learning curve here. And remember, I think this is key. I mean, people have seemed to have, like, just sort of erased this from their minds. The Grizzlies tried to trade up and get Donovan Clingan. Like, that was who you wanted number one. This Edey thing, while, yes, there are many places that it looks like he can fit and can probably do a good job sort of replicating what Steven Adams gave you, it's not a perfect fit in the sense that he doesn't play today's NBA game. And so what there was always going to be, while folks had penciled him in, put him in, and rightfully so as the starter, this idea that, you know, he's just going to come out and dominate, you know, be Yao Ming to start this year. No, it wasn't going to happen like that. I think you guys nailed it, too. I thought Walker Kessler has had this probably circled for a while, yeah, because of everything he had to hear after Edey's summer league debut. The fact that he did it against not just a real NBA player, but a guy who had been on the FIBA team. I mean, you know, and he'd been hearing that for a while now. So you got his best effort. The other thing, too, I thought John Collins got in his head. I said this on our show very early on. You know, it's hard to tell with Zach Edey because he plays with an emotionless face. But I thought the 1 of 5 from the free throw line sort of told you, well, he may not be, John Collins might not be, you know, have punked Edey out here. You know, that's extreme, but clearly he's in his head. He's thinking. John Collins got him thinking. And so I thought Utah did a good job particularly of going tough at him between the two of those guys, and that's to be expected, guys. And so, again, from while there is a great deal of pressure on this rookie starter on a team that has a chance to be a contender, the odds are he's going to look a lot better against Houston, and the odds are you're going to have some other games where, oh boy, that doesn't look so good. And so it'll be up and down. It typically is for rookies. And I wasn't overly discouraged on the fact that he fouled out in 15 minutes. And we realized he's got a lot to learn, Cobb, because that's where I was sort of on Zach Edey.
Do you feel better or worse or no change at all after seeing one game?
I feel better, man, because I think I feel better about the entire roster. I mean, even guys like Jay Huff last night looked ready. Zach Edey goes down, Jay Huff comes in, hits a couple of threes, yep, for you, and also active defensively. No, he's not some a shot eraser, but he's active. He's active around the basket. He changed some shots last night. I saw a guy that does play, a center that does play today's NBA game, and whether it was that or Jalen Wills or, you know, even John Conchar, in a moment where you needed it because you're already shorthanded, those guys delivered. And again, you outscore Utah's bench. Now, I ain't saying much. Utah's not a deep roster, but you're doing it with guys who theoretically were supposed to be outside the rotation before we got the news of the injuries to Vince and to Gigi. So that's a good sign. You know, the depth of this roster, it's what you hoped it would be, and that was on display last night with that shorthand second. You know, Brandon Clark didn't have that. Your usual sixth man extraordinaire didn't have to shine to get what I think it was like a 37, 36-ish bench point effort, 37, 33. I think they outscored Utah somewhere around there, you know, to get some solid production from that bench. And so, again, I'll be honest with you. There's something about Jalen Wills, man. There's something about his poise. There's something about his fearlessness when it comes to taking big shots. And I know summer league preseason was most of it so far. But the guy looks ready, man. And you know, growing 9 inches in high school and, you know, I think he grew another in college or whatever it was, 9 inches, high school, college. You know, he's one of those freak stories that, you know, on a team that just a year, you know, it was just a year ago. You're hoping Marcus Smart can finally solve things at the wing, be what Dylan Brooks wasn't, but you had Zaire Williams and Roddy's. Look at what you've got behind Marcus Smart now. If he's not ready to go, if he can't get in shape, whether it's Vince, whether it's Gigi, or maybe even whether it's Jalen Wells down the road, you have to feel good about this roster right now. And I thought last night was evidence of that.
All right, Jason, next time I talk to you, we will have seen the Memphis Tigers play against an Alabama team that a lot of folks have ranked number one in various preseason polls. What do you want to see from the Tigers? What would constitute a positive outcome, especially relative to what we saw against North Carolina? What do we need to see from the Tigers when they take on Alabama on Monday night?
First thing we need to see, Cobb, is all of them there and accounted for and not having NIL issues or saying that I haven't been paid and needing to step away. I mean, quite frankly, that's you know, it seems like stating the obvious, but, you know, you've had, you know, Penny flipped the staff a few weeks back, and now, you know, you had Tyreek Smith and the possibility he might be gone or not, and you have to give Penny some credit for seemingly stomping that out and keeping him, because I think Tyreek Smith is going to be the kind of role player, it feels like, that Penny Hardaway needed more of last season when things fell apart. Now, we'll see. I mean, in terms of how this works out, what doesn't concern me is where they're ranked. You know, I think last year taught us that, or frankly, you know, even if you get to Cobb, if you get through conference season and it's okay, last year's 11-2, you know, say it's a little worse, and there's a good chance it is, because you're having to figure out a pecking order on the fly against a non-conference schedule that's even better. You know, could this thing flip around? And Calkins has made the point where you struggle early on and it comes together later, yeah, sure. Back to your question, against Alabama, what I'd like to see is Penny not playing at vanilla like he said he did against North Carolina. Keyword, said he did against North Carolina. I know vanilla offensively, they didn't run any sets. He said we weren't going to do that because there's a chance you play him. But defensively, he said, well, we didn't trap Trimble, and we wouldn't have trapped R.J. Davis because we didn't want to show anything. We didn't press. Key to this season, Cobb, you know this, is Memphis getting back to defensively where it had been under Penny Hardaway. Prior to last year, the worst he'd been is like 54th in the country defensively. Efficiency, KenPom, using KenPom numbers here. I think I went back and looked at that earlier today. Last year's like 104. We didn't recognize it. I mean, he's been one. He's been five. That's the coach that, you know, that's the thing that you could hang your hat on about Penny Hardaway's teams. They played hard defensively. So that against Alabama. Let's see a real effort. You've used North Carolina and Alabama, these ranked top 10 teams, as tests for your team this preseason. Well, let's go out and really test and see what you can do defensively, particularly, because it's there more than anything, I think, offensively right now. It's there defensively where, you know, if you're going to do what you're supposed to do this season, you need to make sure that's right. So go out there and, I mean, again, an exhibition situation where you're not playing Lamont or CBU and maybe getting nothing out of it. There's something to be gained here. And hopefully it's some knowledge of what you can do defensively, at least a little bit better knowledge.
How do you feel about the actual roster?
I feel better about the backcourt than I do the front court. Tyrese and PJ are going to be just fine. In fact, it's probably going to be enough on most nights to do what you need to do in the AAC. I'm concerned about the front court now. I'm concerned about Dane Danger and Musa Cissé, the fact that neither one of them can hit free throws. How do you play them at the end of the game, at games? Does that mean at the end of the games you're going to be going small, going to Nick Jourdain as a five, or maybe it's to Tyreek, who knows? But my point is that Musa, you could not play 2-3 years ago when he was here at the end of games. Dane Danger may be in the same boat. So those front court questions, I think, I may be a little bit more concerned about them after seeing it against UNC than I was. And also, Jeffrey and I say this, I think maybe from a team standpoint defensively, I think there's enough length and bodies out there to do what you want to do, pressing, trapping, those kinds of things. I do wonder who's the individual stopper. I think I've said that. Who's the Caleb Mills? Who's the guy when Trimble's going off that, yeah, we're not running anything, we're not going to trap him, but I'm gonna keep him from getting to 33. Do they have one of those guys? Who is that? Because, once they lost Mills last year, yeah, you can play some team defense, but at some point you need one of those guys on the perimeter to want to do it too and be that, hey, I'm going to go shut this guy down. Who's that guy for this team? I still think you need one. It's been Alo, around here for years, and whether it's effective, ineffective, that was a guy I wanted. Who's Penny going to lean on when he doesn't, without a Caleb Mills or an Alo type, who's going to be that guy on the team?
So we got Tyrese Hunter at number 95 on our CBS Sports list of the top 101 players going into the season. Fair, unfair, slash, would you have maybe even had a different Tiger on that list if there was going to be one?
Yeah, probably not. No. I mean, we'll see. In terms of, you're talking about what's on this roster right now and who should be on that list?
I'm thinking, you can make the case for P.J. Haggerty to be on there over Tyrese Hunter.
P.J. is the one, if I'm going to pick one, it's him. I think the key there is that what she did at Tulsa with that high usage rate, right, getting the having the ball at all times, you were concerned because now you're playing in a backcourt where Tyrese is going to have the ball a lot. Is P.J. Haggerty going to be as effective playing off ball? Against UNC, he was bringing it up a ton, and you see what Penny Hardaway's plan is. It's not going to be just one guy bringing it up. But back to my point, we question whether that's going to translate. Can he be as effective and as impactful with less? And so far, so good. Man had 24-9 against UNC, and yeah, that looked like it's going to translate. So, Cobb, if I was going to put one on there, it'd certainly probably be Haggerty. And a guy, too, that, I mean, the 9 rebounds, he sticks around the rim, he can get in the passing lanes before he gets steals. Did that at Tulsa last year. He may be your guy that's, I'm saying, that defensive got to step up, but there's so much on him. He does so much already. I'm not sure, can he handle that and an offensive load? But Haggerty looks like it's going to translate. That's what's important. This isn't, you did it on a loser last year. Can you do it on a more balanced attack? Can you be as impactful as a good sign of how you played against UNC that you can?
Jason, we appreciate it, buddy.
Y'all take care.
That is Jason Smith of the Jason and John Show. Want to remind you that our friends over at Birdies are getting into the Halloween spirit. And if you go in on Friday or Saturday night, you will be part of the costume contest. So it doesn't matter Friday or Saturday. You will be judged one way or the other, and they will announce the winner on Sunday, and you could win a $100 gift card for the best costume. Also, of course, it is Golftoberfest in October. That means that you can reserve online and get half off standard rates for the entire month of October. Also, if you're going to be hosting a holiday party for your work, for your group, whatever it may be, you can do so by booking right now this month. Even if it happens in November or December, you will still get the Golftoberfest ratings. Charlie Knight has been rebranded as South Main Night Market. You can come warm up your vocal cords on Saturday night, select your favorite tunes, and join in this weekend for not one but two great nights of Birdies Scaraoke. It's on Simulator 2 from 7 until close. Golfatbirdies.com. Golfatbirdies.com. Make sure you're also following them on Instagram at Birdies901. We come back, we tell your story next, right here on Jeffrey Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. All right, Cobb, for today's Don't Tell These Story, Tell Your Story, we go to the New York Giants owner, John Mara. Obviously, we're all very disappointed with where we are right now, but I'm going to say one thing. We're not making any changes this season, and I do not anticipate making any changes in the offseason either. So let me get this straight. Not making any changes right now in October. I want to be also clear. I think Dable's a good coach. I'd be fine if they got rid of Shane, whatnot. It's just, why do you even need to say anything? Like, literally all you just said was, well, we didn't fire him today.
They're saying, hey, we're not the New York Jets.
We're not the Jets, even though we have the same record. I want to thank Jason Smith for joining the program. If you missed anything, be up on the podcast shortly after the program ends. For Dennis, for Cobb, this is Jeffrey saying thanks for listening. Keep listening. The Gabe Kuhn Show is coming up next.